Welcome to the Drive Phase Podcast, the best podcast for information on issues surrounding sports business in the Caribbean. On the Drive Phase, we have discussions with sports administrators, coaches, athletes, and various stakeholders in the sporting industry and examine their contribution to sports and entrepreneurship. Here's your host, Dalton Myers.
Our next guest is known for his work in market research. In fact, he has been involved in that area for over four decades. However, for this episode, we're going to be talking to him about his role in sport administration for some time now, probably about the same four decades. Don Anderson has been involved as an administrator with Jamaica teams to several major events and has also chronicled his experience garnered from managing these Jamaican teams at six Olympic Games in a book titled Soul to Beijing. Don has also been first vice president for the Jamaica Olympic Association for a while. And even though the Olympics has been postponed, we have decided to continue our Olympic series with my good friend, Don Anderson. Don, welcome.
Hey, Dalton, how are you doing, man? Thanks for inviting me, and I'm happy to be on your program.
Really glad to have you. Now, listen, straight off the bat, which is your favorite Olympic Games that you have been to?
That's one of the easiest questions I've ever been asked. That would be Beijing. That would be Beijing by a long stretch.
All right, so we're going to be talking a few about that experience in terms of Beijing. But I thought I'd also just ask you to, you know, walk us through what are some of the planning that goes into these major games, such as the Olympics?
First of all, what is not widely known is that the planning for any big games like an Olympic Games starts about a year before, at least a year before. I'm talking about serious work now. Because prior to that, you know, you have all the communication with the local organizing committee, which is the city where the game is going to be held. But serious planning really starts about 12 months out, with the first thing being the chef de missions meeting, which is generally held exactly 1 year before the games in the same city, around about the same time, all right? For obvious reasons. You can get a feel for the climate, for what's happening, the level of preparation, state of readiness, that kind of thingy. So prior to that, of course, there had been a lot of planning leading up to that meeting. But in serious sort of work really begins after that, where you're going to have to get all of your entries right into the local organizing committee in the most timely manner. And that in itself sounds easy. It is not, because, you know, you have to make sure that all your entries, you have a long list and a short list. So long before you decide upon your team and you have trials, you have to submit a very long list of names of anybody who could possibly be in that team, which means you probably have 200 persons. Now, we have never had an Olympic team with 100 persons, all right? So that long list, obviously, is one in which you try to capture anybody who potentially could make the team, because it's easier to work from that rather than work up towards. So we have captured everybody who could possibly, people who are outsiders, who haven't met the qualifying time yet, what have you. And then, in addition to that, you have to ensure when you get very close to the games now, where you not only have your shortlist, which is the people who you have selected, but you have to make sure that they're in the right categories. Who's going to run the 100? Who is a reserve? Who's going to, in other words, it has to be event related. And that's the final list that you send to the local organizing committee. And is the list which gets the chef de mission into the village in the first place. Without that list, which has been signed off by the local organizing committee, when you get to the place where the games are going to be held, not even the chef de mission can get into the village where we're going to be living for 4 weeks. So that's one of the key requirements.
And the chef de mission is almost a diplomat for the country at the games. It is one of the most important, if not most important, role when games time start.
The chef de mission is what I'd like to call the ambassador for your country in the games, because the buck stops with you, and you have to ensure that you represent your country to the best of your ability. Meaning, you ensure that at the end of the day, your country's name comes out smelling like roses and all the various colognes and perfumes and everything like that. But in other words, that there's nothing that people can hold against your country. There have been brushes, what we've managed over the 7 games that I have been to the Olympic Games, 5 of which I've managed, we have been able to come out of the games with our reputation intact, and not only intact, but significantly enhanced.
The first Olympic Games that you were head of, Don, talk to me about that experience. What were some of the learning outcomes from that to help you moving forward?
Well, I had had a taste of managing a sport team before, because in 1986, I was given the responsibility to manage the Central American and Caribbean Games team to Santiago de los Caballeros in the Dominican Republic. Oh. Now, the Central American and Caribbean Games are the least of the games. But by virtue of the least of the games, they are the low-budget games. And by being the low-budget games, you have most problems in those games. I actually got my experience working in the most difficult games, because they just don't have the facilities in place, you know? They don't have the resources in place, and you have to make do and all that kind of thing. The worst games I've ever been at in my entire life, the Central American and Caribbean Games in 1993 in Ponce, Puerto Rico. So that just tells you. Mm. But the first games I attended was in Seoul, and the head of the delegation was Mike Fennell, and his deputy was Keith Irvington. I was one of the three managers of the team, so to speak. Seoul games are excellent games, excellent games. One of the things that stands out for me is the opening ceremony. It was really an amazing opening ceremony. You didn't know where they were coming from, where they were going to, you know? And the lighting of the torch, for example, was something that I'll forever remember. But in all of that, the administration of the games was efficient, except for the transport, where the Koreans have a knack of talking 8, 9, 10 of them about the same subject and not finding a solution, all right? Because every day we couldn't find our car. You know, we have designated vehicles, maybe 4 or 5, depending on the size of the delegation. And every day is a challenge to find our car. You have a designated vehicle. It has your name on there, your country's name on there. And you have to walk from the village residence, generally about at least a quarter mile or a half a mile sometimes, to the point where you pick up your transport. And even though we call when we're leaving the residence, the dorm, as it were, to say we're on our way, and the people would say, yes, your vehicle is here waiting for you. When you got there, somebody had borrowed it. And then there was a 10-minute discussion between 10 Koreans who couldn't tell you where the car was. Eventually found another one for you. But, you know, the execution of the Seoul games was amazing. One of the things I took away from Seoul, literally took away from Seoul, is that during the games, they kept on coming to us for pins, you know, more and more pins. You know, pins are a real treasure in the game. There are people who go there not to watch the 100 meters, but to trade a pin. And so the local organizing committee kept coming to us every day for pins, and we kept on giving them. Couldn't figure out what they were doing to the pin, because every day we gave them more pins, they came for more pins. When we were about to leave, they came and they handed me a huge portfolio, maybe about 48 inches by 36 inches, to carry home. And I'm like, okay. The chef de mission, Mike Fennell and Mr. Sherbiton, said, you're the rookie. You know, you have to take this home. Obviously, it meant carrying it with you on the plane, all right? Not something we wanted to put. When we opened it, it was a real thing of all the pins of all the countries that competed in the Seoul Olympic Games. Beautifully mounted, beautifully mounted. Yeah. And I felt a little less reluctant to take it home at that point in time, you know, physically take it home with me. But when I did that, I have never taken that to that pin collection to the Olympic office. It came and it went on my office wall, my personal wall in my personal office at Market Research, and it has stayed there for the last 88 until now. 32 years? And it's been there 32 years.
Yeah, 32 years.
It's a showpiece in my office. Mm. I was happy to have been the rookie that year.
Yeah.
The Seoul games are really excellent games. Really excellent games. Top organization. Yeah.
And then after Seoul, we had Barcelona.
We had Barcelona. That was a step down in a number of ways. We had some challenges, especially with the transport. Barcelona, for me, was a complex city. And two things stand out. One is that British Airways, which was the principal carrier into Barcelona, didn't seem to have made any allowance for the huge numbers of persons who would be descending on the city. And therefore, from day one, again, my job then was to ensure that we got everybody back home within the time frame, etc. And I spent the better part of 2.5 weeks going from the residence in Barcelona to the British Airways office, where I was trying to ensure that we could get everybody back home. Tell you how difficult that was. Keith Shervington, who was the sort of general team manager, told me pretty early, you know, Don, it looks like if we don't get this thing organized, I'm going to be left in Barcelona. I can't afford that. I need to get back home. And therefore, if you can, get me on the first flight out of Barcelona. And he meant before the games are over, right? So I spent a lot of time. That was a very challenging experience. After a while, we became so well known in the British Airways office downtown that when we got there, they said, come, Mr. Anderson, let's take you inside. And they gave us a privileged position because they knew we were going to be spending a long time. Mm-hmm. So challenges of getting the team back home really manifested itself there. Not only that, but a lot of the people who were drivers didn't quite know the city well. And I have a very amusing experience. One night, we were heading to the track and field stadium. And we jumped into the personal driver for the chef de mission. And we said to her, no, we want to get to the stadium, track and field. We don't have a lot of time. She says, listen, don't you worry about that. I know my way in the city, so I'm getting there. After we had passed the city, the stadium on our right and on our left a few times, we said to her, and she became quieter and quieter each time. We said to her, excuse me, ma'am, but you know, that's the stadium over there that we're trying to get to. She said, I'm trying to find a route to get there. Right? So we ended up getting to the stadium rather late. And the lady was very sheepish after that. I remember she came back. She was very embarrassed that she couldn't find her way to the stadium.
Yeah.
Because all the drivers are really very highly trained to make sure they get from point to point, you know? But this lady, having bragged how good she was and so on, just couldn't find her way to the stadium. A number of the people who were drivers were from outside of Barcelona. That's the problem.
Yeah, we had a similar thing in Gold Coast, Australia, where a 5-minute drive took us 50 minutes because they were using they were using some application that just wasn't working, you know. Yeah. All right, Don, the other day on this podcast, I spoke to Lance Whitaker, who mentioned that the 2000 Olympics for him was probably the most difficult and embarrassing one for him. For many different reasons, primarily because of the demonstration. You were heavy in management at that time. How was that game for you? And how was some of the decision made to get things going?
Well, let me tell you, it is probably one of my proudest moments amidst a very difficult situation. And I'll give you quickly the background, because really not you remember. Came to the national trials having come off a suspected drug charge. Mm-hmm. She got out pretty late, and therefore, by the time she came to the trial, she didn't really have a lot of competition below her belt. So she came and she finished fourth. Now, I cannot verify what I'm going to say now, but I understand that an arrangement was made for Merlene to switch places with Bev McDonald, who would place third in the 100. So that Merlin could run the 100 because Bev had qualified for both the 100 and the 2. Hmm. I understand, and I'm sure anybody who would deny that this took place, but this is what I understood. That Merlin therefore left Jamaica, as she normally does, the following morning after she runs, and went away to Europe, pretty sure she was going to run the 100 meters. Okay? It appears that the arrangement fell through and she was not told. So she went to Europe. The games were a little bit away from the trials, and therefore Merlin went to Europe and ran times that were faster than any of the top three. 1, 2, and 3 in the 100 ever ran. And therefore, that sort of strengthened her view that she was going to run the 100. So the team assembled in Brisbane amidst national controversy about who was going to run the 100. Some people said Merlene. Jamaica was divided. Peter Gay Dowdy was a national champion, must run. People said Merlene must run, and that was what they went into Brisbane, where the pre-Olympic camp was being held. So recognizing that could present a challenge, I remember speaking to the track and field management from Sydney, where I was then, in Brisbane, to say, guys, we need the name of the person who's going to run 100. And I was told, we have time, cool. What are you worrying about? We have time, man. We have time. I said, no, but you need to get the mind of the athlete in the right frame for running. Therefore, anyway, they resisted that. They came into the village in Sydney, still not deciding who was going to run the 100. Was it going to be Merle Naughty or whoever else of those three? And with about 2 days to go before they had to name this person, I was told they were going to have a meeting that night in the village to determine or to make a decision who was going to run. My charge to the track and field management was, listen, I really don't care who runs the 100. I just need to know that whoever you select, you can give me a documented piece of paper that can say to me the reason why you selected this person. So meeting held about 10 o'clock. At about 12 o'clock, they came out of the meeting and they gave me the paper and I read it. And there were about 10 points on the paper, 10 factors that led them to select Merle Naughty over Peter Gay Dowdy, who was the national champion. And I was like, but guys, I mean, some of this information you're providing to me now was pretty obvious and evident to you from in Brisbane. Why didn't you? It appears that the camp was divided. 8 coaches or so, and we had 4 were for Merlin and 4 were for Peter Gay Dowdy. Bottom line is, they were then scheduled to have a team meeting, a track and field team meeting on the following morning, which was the day before track and field starts. And I remember saying to Lloyd Gooden, my deputy, Lloyd, no matter what we have, we cannot leave the village. We cannot go to any meeting because I suspect we're going to have some challenges. The meeting was held below where we slept, our residence. And about 15 minutes after the meeting started, we heard all kinds of ruckus and noise downstairs and looked outside. I really don't know. Jamaicans are tremendous people. Where they got placards from in 10 minutes. And the placards were all very, very ugly placards about Merlin. And they were marching up to the international zone, which is where all the reporters from around the world gather for the best interviews they can get. 43 athletes went up to the international zone. And after 3 attempts to bring them back, and 1 last warning from the local organizing committee, happily, you know, Jamaica, we know how to work the system. So by then we had known the guy who was the head of the administrative, the National Olympic Committee Center. And we got 3 calls from him. First one said, Don, your people up international zone, they are creating mischief, bring them down. So I asked the track and field management and so on to go up there and get them back down. I got a second call to say, Don, your athletes are still disturbing the games, get them down. When that didn't work, I got a final call and I said, you know, Lloyd, we gotta go. So I grabbed Lloyd Gooden. I said, Lloyd, let's go. On the way up, we met some very distinguished members of the management team coming back down. And I said, guys, where are the athletes? Oh, the chef, you're worried about them soon come back down, man. I said, no, I've got my final warning from the organizing committee. I got up there and I took the names of all the 43 people. Didn't know I could write so fast. There were 43 athletes gathered, mainly track and field, 95% track and field, gathered at the international zone, giving interviews, right? Explaining, venting their feeling about the selection of Merle. And the bottom line was that we were threatened with expulsion. I know that. It wasn't exactly explicit, but I knew that the final call to me said, get your team down or else. Unfortunately, I was able to get 41 of the 43 back into the camp very quickly. And you know what? A lot of them said to me, Mr. Chef, we never know what's going on, you know. Meaning, we just was following the rest of them. But there are 2 athletes who didn't budge. And I will tell you who they are. They're Gregory Horton and Danny McFarlane. And we had problems getting them to understand the nature and the gravity of what they did. But even in the final analysis, we were able to calm the waters. No more challenges, no more problems. It took a while because they were then deciding they're not going to run the relay. They're going to boycott the relay, you know? And we were able to, with a couple of meetings subsequent to that, smooth that out. I'm happy to tell you that before the relay, Gregory Houghton came to my room one morning at about 6:30, knocked on my door and I said, well, Gregory, what's going on? I'm just getting some sleep, and I was up till 3 o'clock in the morning managing the process. Says, there's a chef, I have a letter for you. And it was a letter, handwritten letter of apology from Gregory Houghton, saying he really didn't understand what he was doing. Asked for pardon and pledged his full support for the team after that. That to me was a big movement, big moment. And Gregory and I have maintained a very good relationship since then. When he graduated with his bachelor's, he told me about it, wanted me to come. When he graduated with his master's, he told me about it, sent me pictures. Then he had a doctorate, and Gregory has been a good friend of mine ever since then. But that was the most difficult game for me from that perspective. It was a bad moment.
No, that's interesting.
Bad moment.
Yeah. Then Don, we went, I know I skipped over Atlanta, which is a really important one.
But just as well.
And I'll probably, yeah.
Just as well. Atlanta was the worst in the game for me.
It was.
Yeah.
And I thought in the US it would have been one of the better games.
I normally held in a city that has a sort of cultural environment, something that surrounds the games and makes embellishes and, you know, adorns the game and so on. Atlanta didn't have that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, we were at the, I believe it was Clark University, the dorm, we lived in dorms, you know, and the walk to the dining room was a very important building in Olympic Games, all right?
one of the most important.
Absolutely. I mean, when we go to the chef de mission meeting, again, by virtue of the nature of the relationship we have with the local organizing committee by then, we select our residents on the basis of where the dining room is. And we generally get it. Well, in this case, where we had to walk up some hills and thing, you know, it seemed like hills to get to the dining room. It wasn't the best. And I didn't think the games were as well organized as they should have been. You had some other problems. And I remember that it was at the Atlanta games where we had the bombing, right? A bomb was set off in the park, Sentinel Park. And I remember the physios wanted me to come with them to go and watch what was happening in the park. And I was tempted, but again, my commitment to doing the best job possible as a chef de mission said to me, I can't leave the village tonight. And I decided very reluctantly that I would stay inside the village that night. And I want to tell you, maybe about an hour after they left to go to Centennial Park, they were coming back, they'd come back breathless because they were so close to the bomb that exploded in that park that night. You know, they were so close to it. I said, there got to be a reason why I wasn't there. God was at work again. Because, you know, you never know. They would have been very close to that bomb. But Atlanta, to me, faded in thing. I can't remember too many outstanding things apart from Merlin running down the track, you know, almost the end of the 100 meters, to only to realize that it was a false start. And she never recovered from that.
Yeah. And Dion Emmings, of course, over the...
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I shall tell you that when Dion, the only time in my entire Olympic life, this is a signal moment, the only time in my entire Olympic life where I've ever held a real gold medal for the Olympic Games was when Dion came in back, having been presented with her gold medal in the game. And she came to me in my office and she said, Mr. Anderson, can you keep this for me? I want to make sure it's safe. And I had to say to her, do you know what you're asking me to do? You're asking me to keep your gold medal. I want to tell you, she left it with me. And every morning, I would open my safe and say, make sure it's right in there.
Yeah.
She got it at the end of the game, right? Right? Maybe I can tell you that why that was important. In Sydney, which came 4 years later, at the official flag raising ceremony, I was presented with a beautiful, beautiful, what it's called now, a sort of memento of the games at the flag raising ceremony, you know? And I took it back into my office, laid it securely, I believe, in my office, and I never found it 2 days after that. haven't found it yet. So
yikes.
That explains what I'm talking about with the gold medal.
Yeah. We were talking about Sydney, but then after Sydney 2004 in Athens, the games that Usain Bolt started out at didn't do as well as we expected, but talk to me about that experience.
You know, Athens was not one of the better games. As a matter of fact, Athens really shouldn't have had the games then. They were never prepared. They were very slow at getting off the mark. And when we got to the village in 2004, they were still laying down grass and it was a very rainy time. So I can tell you that for every day we were traversing mud running down the village. Okay? Mm-hmm. It wasn't one of the better games. It wasn't well organized. And it was one of those games that as chef had a very difficult time receiving athletes because most of the flights that brought athletes in came in like 2 o'clock and 3 o'clock in the morning. By the time I got there, the level of preparation for receiving athletes in terms of all the documentation, etc., had not been complete. So the chef de mission had to drag on his tracksuit over his pajamas because he would go to bed at 2 o'clock having gone to meet 2 athletes, back up to the residence quarter mile or more to get a call from the administration desk at the point to say 2 more of your athletes have arrived. They can't come in unless the chef de mission go back down there. And it was that kind of thing. So it was a very, very difficult game for me. And I can tell you, and I can say this publicly, that maybe 2 weeks into the games, on one occasion I had to be going down to the center of city for a meeting. And my driver, who had been my principal driver, said to me, I'm diverting, Mr. Anis. I said, where are you going? So that I'm taking you because I've watched you every day you sit in this car, you fall asleep immediately. And I realize you're very tired. So I'm taking you down to the harbor and I bought a ticket for you to take a half day trip across to one of the islands. Right? Even though I insisted, I said, no, I can't. He said, Mr. Anderson, I am driving the car. I have the ticket, I'm taking you. And I took a half day off, right? No, it was important. And I believe that I was 2004. In 2005 early, I was diagnosed as being diabetic. And I believe that was the principal trigger, those games. They were very, very difficult games. Very difficult games. It was the games that Usain Bolt made his debut in the Olympic Games, right? And I believe that the world would record Usain Bolt finishing down the track in his very first and only race in the 2004 Olympic Games. With his chain between his teeth, and people are saying, what an idiot boy, you know, running a chain between. That's why I can't run in on people, wrote off Usain Bolt. The fact of the matter is that Usain, by then, had run world times, had run men's times. He was still 18. Actually, he wasn't 18 when he left here for the Olympic Games, right? And there was a big debate in the Olympic Association because, you know, we have to ratify the final teams, right? All the various sport disciplines name their team to the Olympic Association and we ratify it and then we send it off to the local organizing committee. In other words, we are the intermediary between every national federation and the Olympic organizing committee. When we saw Usain's name, we questioned whether he should be going. But because he had been injured and, you know, he's just coming off an injury, he was still growing his muscularity and so on, was not in pace with, you know, a lot of things. Eventually we said, all right, you know, the guy has looked like he has the potential, so we will pencil him in. And Usain Bolt went off to the Olympic Games, having beaten a number of very good men in that lead up to the game.
Yeah.
I believe that once he got down on the track for the 200 meters, which he ran, and he realized how many people were in that stadium, when he looked up and he saw 80,000 people, I think Usain froze. Because he finished fifth or sixth in that one heat, never qualified beyond that first round, and people wrote him off. The rest is history.
Yeah,
celebrated his 18th birthday along with Sharon Simpson, and as part of the thing that you do in Olympic Games, we had a cake. Both of them celebrated their birthday, so we ordered a nice big cake and shared it up amongst the team. And you'd be amazed at some of the things that create problems. Not everybody got a piece of the cake. And people were claiming you know, that one delivery, serve them out to the cake, you know, that type of thing. But yeah, that lasted for a day because what I'm leading up to the start of track and field, there's a lot of tension. People are tight and people are nervous and people are all high strung, you know. So there was a fair amount of confusion about that take, but we survived that too.
You know, Don, I listened to you. I haven't been to an Olympic Games in terms of management, but certainly.
I don't know what you're missing.
No, that's fine.
The good and the bad.
One of the things I said though about games, and I remember at the Commonwealth Games as Chef de Mission, John Welsh was coordinating some things for Jamaica, and he decided, Dalton, you have to take a day off. He decided, I'm going to take a day off. He has a ranch, have some horses, and I'm going horseback riding and all kind of stuff.
Yep.
And his wife asked for my phone. You know,
yep.
She's like, I'm going to take your phone. The agreement I had to make is that I'm going to keep the phone, but I won't look at it just in case there's an emergency.
Right.
You know? And I got, I think, one time to look at the phone. When I look at it, there was some rugby guy who got injured, and I decided, you know what, they'll solve that. You know,
yeah.
And it was probably the best day of the games for me. Is that
I can
one
tell
day.
You, that was my experience in Athens too. Got on a night of the boat and I sailed across to a little place. Took down, had some lunch and thing, and the guy was waiting for me when I came back home. Man, I was never more refreshed.
Yeah.
You see, let me just quickly say that a lot of people think that when you go to an Olympic Games, it's all fun and you watch all the events. I can tell you that, and you would know, that halfway through the games, you realize, you know, you really haven't seen any events yet, and you make an effort. Because it's so much work to make sure you keep on top of things and the name of Jamaica, your country, remains untarnished to the world. That's the bottom line.
And that's one of the things I wanted to ask you, even before I get into the whole Beijing, which was a big one for us. It's just about the amount of work that must go into the games, and not just go into it, but when you get there, the first 2 weeks, when you're there, the amount of work done, talk to us about that, and that goes into just preparation, problem solving, you know?
Those are the most difficult times. I mean, the chef de mission has to get there a couple of days ahead. And normally I request the assistance of somebody else who I know I can work with. Because when I say work, because a lot of the pre-arrival planning takes place there before the teams begin to come in. You have to sort out, you have to sign off on every single room and every single item in every single room. Sign off, sign the dotted line to make sure that you have everything that you need. And that they make sure that you have signed off on everything that they have provided for you. It means that you have to ensure that all those items are maintained. All the desk fans, all the computers, all the stuff, right? And that normally is a walkthrough. Now, what's very important is that we have been blessed. As a country, we've been blessed. And we've been blessed with volunteers because every game you're assigned volunteers and people trip over each other. People don't quite understand this. People trip over each other to be volunteers for Jamaica.
Yep.
And people have been known to leave other camps and filter into Jamaica camp to volunteer to work along with us. They are the people who make your life less difficult because they are the go-to people. You can get them to do that, get them to do that, get them to do that. Walk with you to check through every room to make sure every item is there. And they're the ones that run to the NOC office for your letters, for your mail, for this, to carry this, to carry in there. The forms to request, you know, people to come into the village the next day. Believe you me, it's a lot of hard work before you get there. And I can tell you how difficult it is, if you don't mind me saying quickly.
No, man, go right to
Sydney. In Sydney, we had an event planner as one of our four volunteers, a very mature lady. And she says she has done events in Sydney all over the place. She's a top professional event planner. So for the first couple of days before track and field, which is the largest delegation, comes in, I kept on saying to her, you know, let's call her Janet. Janet, when track and field comes, it's going to be difficult, you know. So don't go by what you see now. Placid, we all have about 10 people in. I said, Mr. Anderson, I've done this over and over again. Don't you worry about that, right? So we had everything planned. On the night that track and field were supposed to arrive, she went out and she made sure that all the names were on all the doors because we got room allocation, who was going to be rooming to do. everything, all the bags were in their rooms, everything was aligned properly. She said, everything is fine. They were supposed to come in on two flights, one arriving about 4 to 5 minutes apart. And we said, beautiful. So we just wait for the second flight. Everybody comes in one time. Everybody goes to their room. Everything is laid down. So Murphy intervened because one of the flights was delayed by about 2 hours. We said, no, we can't have them waiting. So yeah, the first batch came in. Man, everybody said, me not like my room, you know. Who my room with? No, sir. And I tell you, chaos ensued. You'll never understand. You know where I found my event planner? On the way out with her bag over her shoulder, having resigned because she said she had never seen anything like this before. I had to rush to the gate, plead with her. I said, listen, I kind of prepped you as to what it was going to be like. You probably didn't anticipate this, but I told you, day after day, when track and field comes in, it's a different ballgame. She said, Mr. Anderson, I thought I could manage it, but it was beyond me. Mm-hmm. It was beyond me. I have to resign. Persuaded her, she stayed on, and she had happier days. But believe you me, you know, those things are major, major problems that just hit you, and you have to deal with it.
I kind of laugh because, yeah, it's even after you get that rooming list from the respective teams, the respective associations, when track and field arrive in that village, it's a different story.
Different ball game.
Different ball game. Don, one of the things you said to me when I first approached you, 2017 or 2018, before I went to the Commonwealth Games, you said one of the biggest challenge is not necessarily the athletes, but management. And I'm paraphrasing now. What are some of the challenges that we face just in general with getting our coaches, managers for teams to just cooperate on games and getting everything right?
Well, one of the things is that the managers don't quite often recognize that they're part of a big team, a bigger team, you know? So there tends to be a fair amount of cliquism in amongst the delegations, which we try to break down much. But unfortunately, a lot of the managers don't quite appreciate the role they should play. And we've had to dig officials out of their beds at 2 o'clock in the afternoon when they should have been elsewhere, you know? I mean, things like those, I mean, big men and big, you know, who you expect would understand their responsibility. But part of the challenge has been that in my particular position, because I'm committed to doing a good job, is that we have a roster of where people should be each day, you know? Apart from the fact that based on your team size and your team kind of makeup, you have one doctor per et cetera, whatever. Have to make sure we allocate the resources very efficiently. And that is made known to everybody each day. And there was one particular day where I got a call from the track and field manager. He was at the warm-up track somewhere along the line and he needed some medical attention. And he said, I said, but you have X, Y, and Z assigned. He said, but they're not here. So I inquired around and one of the members of the team said, I said, Chef, you knock on the man them doors. I said, no, but it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I mean, why would I do that, you know? I said, well, I think them still in them room, you know. I said, no, man. Went and knocked. Sure enough, two officials that were needed were bam, sleeping in their room at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, right? And I'm telling you that this is the sort of challenge that you find, in addition to which sometimes you find some of the officials, and I'm just going to be frank and sometimes you find some of the officials who really don't go there with a sense of purpose about ensuring that the team's well-being is taken care of. And therefore, a lot of them you find are missing when they should be around, or they borrow the team car somewhere along the line and they go off somewhere. So it is always an important thing to ensure you have a really good rapport and a good understanding between yourselves and the management. So that, because they are really the buffer between you and the players and the athletes, you know. The chef de mission really has nothing to do with the athletes, except being a nice, good social ambassador and friend, you know, to make sure.
Right.
Because there are levels between yourself and the athletes, you know, immediate coach or manager, and then, you know, up to the chef. But I've found that in a number of games that I've been to, I've actually had to do a lot more personal intervention. Again, part of it is the personality, because you do have to have a certain personality to be a chef. You can't be a cut and dry person who, if you make a mistake, you get sent home. That is always going to happen if you take that position, right? And I remember in Beijing, for example, we had a long jumper. Can't remember, Chelsea something or not.
Chelsea Hammond.
Something like that. Anyway, a long jumper. Never heard about her before, right? But very attractive lady. And I remember on prior to the start of the games, we had a fashion show one night that Puma put on. And that's when I saw this lady. I said, oh, but this lady is not supposed to be an athlete, you know? Anyway, walking through the village every day, as I did very often from residence room to dining room to various places, I'd run into the athletes from time to time. Two of them stand out, Sharon Simpson, who I remember being very, very nervous about her 100. Very nervous. And I'm like saying to myself, but hey, I mean, there has to be somebody to talk to Sharon about how she's feeling. And I remember the morning that she was going to be running her first heat. She was like a wreck, right? And I passed her, I was about to pass her on the way to the dining room. And I realized that she was very tense. And I said, hey, you can do this thing, in a man. And then just a couple words of encouragement to her, right? And she, the rest is history again. Now, Sharon and I have maintained a very special relationship since then. If you come to my office, one of the photographs I have with myself and Sharon at some function or another, very pleasant situation. And what that did was to encourage Sharon and really motivate her. Just a little talk with her. The other more important thing that I'm going to tell you about is Chelsea. Because this lady, I never knew her from Adam. But we'd pass each other on the way and I would say, hey, how are you today? Everything good? You know, not thinking this is just my normal style. Passing you and say, hey, everything cool, man? Everything all right? How are you feeling today? Da-da-da-da-da-da. Chelsea, from a total unknown to me and many others, I imagine, she finished 7th in the long jump final in those games, right? One of the first emails I got when I got back home from Sydney was from Chelsea. And it said, Mr. Anderson, people don't realize what it means to just have a good morning and a hello and good wish. It meant a lot to me. Like, you know, I mean, that one tore me up because I didn't think I was doing anything special.
Yeah.
I was saying, hey, you know, normal thing, almost my kind of laid back saying, how are you doing? Everything cool? Yeah, yeah, man. All the best here. That kind of thing. It meant so much to her. I didn't realize.
Yeah.
Right? But she made me know that it was a fantastic experience for her. Right? So I've had a lot of problems with the officials, with athletes too. But, you know, the athletes you expect because they're high strung.
Yeah, you know.
And the job is to, they're high strung. And, I mean, it's crazy. But I remember in Beijing, you haven't started to talk about Beijing. But in Beijing, one athlete came to me one morning to ask me if I could arrange. I could go and buy a bucket for her and some detergent. And I'm like scratching my head. No, where's this coming from? Because in Beijing, you had more than anything you could want. All the machines, all the dryers. Everything you could want. You know, when you're going into your residence, there was always, what do you call these guys who open the door for you and stuff like that with a nice little, valet, open the door for you. When you're coming up back, he opens the door for you. Everything you wanted in Beijing. All the washing machines right in your residence. A lady wanted to buy a bucket for her and some detergent. And I'm like, excuse me, but why would you want that? She says, me no wash my clothes, nobody clothes, and me no want. Well, you know, with a different personality, I had to say, listen, man, you know. But I found a way to work her through it without making her feel badly about it.
Yeah.
And eventually, you know, she did very well. But that is part and parcel of the challenge you have every day. Amidst all the other things you're doing to make sure that everything is running fine, you're going to have these interventions, right, that detract or try to detract.
Yeah, let's go to Beijing then.
How much time you have left?
I know we could talk forever about that one.
Yes.
But general, Beijing has been one of our best games in terms of just performances. And I guess for you in terms of managing would be, as you said at the start of the show, your favorite.
Yeah, Beijing is my favorite for not just the fact that this was a turning point. This was the turning point. But, you know, this is when Usain Bolt turned up big time, really big, big time. From relative, you know, what in 2004, with that sense, 2008, by which time now the guy is a world record holder. Mm-hmm. And apart from the performances on the track, Beijing, to me, really gave me pleasant, pleasant memories, right? Leading up to the games, it rained every day. Every day. Track and field due to start tomorrow. And we were there worrying that, boy, they couldn't start the game because it was raining so much. All the smog was over Beijing. Mm. And we said, good God, boy, I mean, nobody's going to know who won the 100 meters, you know? Well, on the night before the games started in earnest, which is on track and field, it started to rain about 6 o'clock the evening. And it rained torrentially, like it used to rain in Port Antonio, my hometown. It rained torrentially. We could not, I mean, I remember my chef de mission now was, what's his name? Soon tell his name, right?
2008? I don't remember what it was.
2008. Anyway, it will come back to me, don't worry, all right? So, it rained. It rained, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock. Now we hungry and we want to go to the dining room, all right? Compton Rodney was this thing. We want to go to the dining room. And, you know, the way in which I operated my deputies is that we kind of walk together to the dining room because that's when we think through what has happened to the day and so on. So we always walk around. And we'd rain and rain. And at about 11 o'clock, we had not eaten because we couldn't get out there. We just couldn't get out. Raincoat, hood, everything. We couldn't get out. About 11 o'clock, said, no, boy, we got to go and eat. Dining room, of course, is open 24 hours for those who don't know. And right. You can get any food you want. We've been there about 10 days. There are about 80 different booths or stands from which you can get food. And by then, you know, we had seen everything. So we said, boy, come to, what are we going to eat tonight, man? And we began to walk up and down in the dining room looking for food, looking for something we really wanted to eat that we hadn't eaten 6 times before.
Yeah.
And out of the blue, from behind the serving station, came a voice that said, what are you guys looking for? Ackee and saltfish? Like, hold on a minute now. All that we had seen up to then were Chinese faces, Chinese cooks, Chinese servers, Chinese so-and-so. So we said, where's this voice coming from? We looked up. There was a dark guy, big dark guy, in his, whatever cap you call it. And the guy says, yeah, man, what are you guys looking for? Ackee and saltfish? I said, hold on a minute, man. We went over to him. He was the head chef in Beijing. Jamaican guy, countryman. He was there. He was on contract with a Canadian company and he was the head chef. And we just jokingly said to him, boy, we wish we could get some rack of lamb, man. We want something different. And he whispered, he said, well, I have a little in the back there, but you can't let anybody know.
Yeah.
Just hold on. Go and sit down over there. And the guy fixed up some rack of lamb for us, you see, man.
Yeah.
Eat anything we had in New Zealand, right? Okay. Well,
No, one other thing I was going to ask as you talk about that, yeah. and sorry to break you on that, in terms of the the nutritional support for games like Beijing, you know, for both management, athletes, etc. How did you find that compared to other games?
Excellent. I mean, we found that, of course, at every Olympic Games, you know, there's food for everybody. Mm-hmm. So no matter what you eat, they're about, as I said, there's African, Asian, Mediterranean, Caribbean, whatever. Mm-hmm. There's always, and it's top class, really top class, really top class. And anybody, I've never been to an Olympic Games where the food has not been first class. Never. And Beijing, I believe, topped the list, okay? But I digressed a little bit because they're telling you about the rain and smog and so on, right? So let me just finish that quickly. So it rained all night. When we woke up the following morning, I've never seen such blue skies in my life, right? Track and field started, went through without any hitch, no rain. And we learned afterwards that, you know, the guys, the Chinese guys sent a few satellites up in the sky and, you know, they had seeded the clouds and they just withdrew whatever was happening. And we had excellent weather for the rest of the games until the night before the closing ceremony, when they decided that you would wait outside, all the athletes and the officials parading had to wait outside And at the chef de mission meeting in the morning, we expressed concern. We said, but what if it rains? I mean, you know, what are we going to do? I mean, we're outside in the open. What's the... And the Chinese man who was in charge of the logistics leaned forward in his chair and said, it will not rain. And it did not rain. All right. So, you know, tremendous experience. Beijing was a class act by itself, really, really. Not to mention the on the track.
Yeah, before I get to on the track, quickly, before the games, also there were concerns about pollution in the atmosphere because Beijing is one of those cities. But during the game, that pollution was reduced.
That's part of what they did. You know, they made sure where we never saw any inner city, we never saw any shacks anywhere along the road. We never saw any, because, you know, by then, you know, they had insisted on certain restaurants being closed. And they had moved a lot of the people out of the precincts of the Olympic area. And everything was sanitized, right? And the area was like perfect, really perfect. So we never had any challenges with the smog. We were worried about it leading up to the game, leading up to the start, especially of track and field. But when that rain came that night, it washed away all of that thing. And the city was clean. The city was beautiful. We could traverse the city because, as you know, in your Olympic vehicle, you have Olympic lanes. We had no challenges getting from venue to venue. They were all well marked, et cetera, et cetera. And you had the authoritarianism of the Chinese, no question. But Jamaicans have a way of beating all of that.
Right? Yeah.
And you know, we have day passes. 14 day passes are what we are allocated. Day passes are allocated for you to bring people into the village so that they could see what the village is like, meet a couple of the athletes. On the basis of the size of your delegation, you're allocated a certain number. We had 14. We said, boy, we don't think that we are going to be able to manage 14 because there are a number of Jamaicans that we knew. So we went down to the gate pass center every day pleading to see if we could get more than 14. Couldn't work. The guy just said, no, dismiss us. Bolt won the 100 meters. Bolt won the 200 meters. Our demand from Jamaicans and others to come into the village soared by about four times. So I said, boy, I'm going to make a last-ditch effort to see if I could get more than 14. You can't tell people can't come in and think. I went back down there and I walked with a Jamaica pin. And I said to the guy in charge of the gate pass center, we'd like to get a few more. Can we exchange a pin with you? And he looked at the pin and he says, how many more do you need? The next day we got 40 passes. 40. So,
and part of that though, Don, is that people don't understand one, what Usain Bolt and Shelley and Fraser Price has done on the track and how that has opened up doors for us. And secondly, what our clothing means to other people when we go to major games and what those pins, those simple emblems mean.
Absolutely.
It's almost trading gold when you go to major games.
Absolutely. Absolutely. As I said, pin trading is a huge item in the games, right? Jamaica has traditionally had some of the best looking pins in the game. It's the most sought after pin in the game. People have run me down at airports when they know that we're from Jamaica and we have a pin. Have run me down from one side of the airport to another, begging that pin, prepared to pay for it. I'll give you an idea how valuable it is. In London, when we were clearing up, now the games are over, we were clearing up, we had a Jamaican guy working in the cleanup party. And he said to me, I have one pin left, Mr. Anderson. And a man offered me £250 for it yesterday, and I turned him down. £250. He said, nah, I'm not giving you this pin.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
It's the most sought after pin in the games. People don't quite understand the value of the Jamaica brand at the Olympic Games. And to a large extent, Usain Bolt, Shelley-Ann Fraser-Pryce, and others have made that difference. At the Olympic Games, we are the biggest brand. No matter how many medals we win, we are. And I can tell you, walking around the stadium in the night, when Usain Bolt is running, and Shelley and Fraser Price is running, and Veronica Campbell-Brown is running, and Johan Blake and so on. But Usain Bolt and Shelley and Fraser Price is an amazing experience. Because we have to wear our identified uniform, obviously. Right. Black and green and gold, everywhere we go. And when you're walking, people are getting up. Because people just want to meet somebody from Jamaica. because we're such a big brand in the Olympic Games. Amazing. And for me,
yeah,
I think I've been able to hold it well because, believe you me, I'd walk in from the bathroom to go back to my seat, for example, and the number of people who would really just descend on us, right? Just wanted autographs, mm-hmm. wanted photographs. And there were people in Jamaica who were there
yeah.
who said, listen, I've never been so photographed in my entire life. They were stopped on the streets. I mean, I like everywhere because Usain Bolt and Shelley and Fraser Pryce yeah. really must put their stamp on the Olympic Games forever. It will never change. Never change.
Yeah. And then, Don, when the games have finished, it's another set of work to be done. It's not just pulling down, but it's ensuring everyone gets to the airport. Tell our listeners about that experience also, because now the games are finished. Everyone is happy going home, but the chef and managers have to kind of stay back.
First in, last out.
Last out. Away.
We go in and we have to check the inventory. And we talk about inventory. You know, we don't want the light bulbs, chairs, everything. Whole set of inventory. When we're leaving, we have to do that check through again. Again, happily, we have our volunteers to work with us to make sure how we go from room to room to room. And what is not accounted for, we have to pay for. Okay?
Yep.
But that's a part of that. In addition to that, of course, we normally have quite a few athletes who get on the circuit. And therefore, whatever travel plans that we have had prior to, which we have had to make, we sometimes have to break those and ensure that we can work with them to get them back home, you know? It's a major experience. And the last day is always very difficult, the day in which we tick off everything and hand over back those keys to the organizing committee to say, yes, we have accounted for everything or we've paid for what we can't account for.
Yeah.
All right?
Yeah.
And that to me is a nightmare. One of the things that we had to do in Beijing, for example, because we didn't have enough television sets to go around. We thought we did, but we had to go and buy a few more on the market in Beijing. Except that when we're now leaving, so what are we going to do with these 5 television sets? Because we can't carry them back home. One of my volunteers said to me the night before we left, he said, Sir Anderson, you want to get rid of these television sets? And I said, sure, but what are we going to do this night? He said, can we put them in the car, sir? Put them in the car. We drove to a point in Beijing. Don't ask me where. And he came up back with the money. He sold those television sets like nothing. Good price. He sold those television sets. I mean, you know, I didn't ask him any questions, to be honest with you. We were so anxious to get to the television sets. We gave away one of them, probably, you know. But the bottom line is that, as you rightly say, the last 2 days before we actually give the keys over, are very difficult days because we have to ensure that everything that we got when we got there and signed for going into the village, we have left intact. That's not easy with 80 odd people. Not easy. Not easy. And quite often we end up with things that are missing that we have to pay for.
Oh God, that's
yeah.
That's another one.
But
we're talking with we're talking about volunteers, and I must add that this year, last week, actually had a Zoom meeting with volunteers from Pan Am Games.
Fantastic.
Because it was so good in terms of those volunteers. You know, we have kept in touch and we had a 1 year anniversary. And,
yeah.
You know, you're talking about the importance of volunteers, and without them, it's headache. It's headache.
Yeah.
They can make or break you in terms of games.
Yeah. I mentioned in the book that I wrote, Soul to Beijing, that the volunteers are really, they make the games for us. Without them, we would be lost. Trust me. And again, we've been blessed with some really good volunteers. And like you, there is one particular from Australia that has come to Jamaica, all right, from Australia, just to maintain that contact with us. And, you know, Compton Rodney and myself, we've actually been in much close contact with them. And she never forgets us. She keeps in touch with us. And that is the case with a number of them that we have actually had the pleasure to work with. There's one gentleman from London who we have a standing joke about because, you know, Compton is an accountant and he was a stickler for making sure he got a safe to keep all the money in.
Right.
And this guy said, Well, not to worry. You know, tomorrow when I'm coming, I can bring the safe for you. We had to rescue him off the road because, you know, I don't know if people know how tight the security is at the Olympic Games, but you can't come within several hundred yards of the thing or come of the village. Yeah. And this guy didn't seem to realize that Compton had bought a big safe. So when he came off the train, he had his safe on top of his shoulder, okay? Eventually, we had to find a way to go out to get him and rescue him. He had his shoulder pain for weeks after we left to London, quite frankly. So it's a big joke with us all, you know. Every time we talk to him, it's always your shoulder, you know?
Yeah.
But the volunteers are really wonderful, wonderful experiences. And we've just maintained good lifelong friendships with volunteers that work with us. Really, they're so glad to be part of Jamaica.
Yeah, oh geez, they talk about it forever. Your experience with Team Jamaica. Yeah. In fact, some of mine at Pan Am Games, I think it was, literally started crying the fact that they were chosen to be volunteers for Team Jamaica.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
I was like, we have ball for.
We have had several tears on our shoulders when we're leaving.
People
who doesn't want us to go, and you know, it's really a tremendous experience. And it just talks in terms of how fantastic a country we are. And the performance is on the track, of course. I mean, help to endear people to us.
Yeah.
I mean, it was sometimes almost embarrassing for me that everywhere I went, people would stop me and want to know about Usain Bolt. And, you know, you couldn't say no. And, you know, you had to chat to a number of people. And then every day the media wanted you. And they couldn't understand that you couldn't be there when they wanted to because you had work to do kind of stuff, you know. But Beijing was a tremendous experience from that perspective. Tremendous.
Dan, we're going to be wrapping up. So let me get about four good recommendations from you for any youngster who is going to want to become a head of delegation or just manager for an Olympic game or major games.
Right. One, I think being confident about your own ability is important because I've had experiences where I'm not a confident person, I would never survive. In that Sydney debacle quickly, when I went to meet the team, because I don't know most of the athletes. And I remember in the midst of all the turmoil, I went up to one young lady and I said to her, good night, my name is such and such, glad to meet you. And the lady looked at me and said, oh, you? like, oh, you? I said, well, chef de mission. What are you doing? You know, and like, I said, coming from an environment where I run my own company and for the debilitating experience for me, but you know, so you have to have that kind of confidence that, hey, you know, I have to ride over that kind of thing, you know. Secondly, I think you have to be a people person. If you're not a people person, you're going to be in trouble, right? By which I mean, you have to be able to relate to people because you're heading a team of sometimes 80 people from different walks of life, different age groups, different aspirations, different hopes, different possibilities, and then mingling together for 3 weeks. They're going to be in a committed family relationship with two people, husband and wife, their problems. Can you imagine an 80 diverse people? Okay? So you have to manage that. You have to really manage that. So being a people person is very important because then you can relate to all the people. You can in fact talk to people and get them on your wavelength. The third thing I like to say is that communication is going to be key. Because, I'm happy that I'm into marketing and communication because, believe you need to be able to communicate well and to be available to and to be able to share with the athletes and the officials that you have under your charge. Not to be a boss necessarily, but to be able to communicate well with them. And throughout, just to maintain that level of contact and respect because respect breeds respect. And when people know that you are in charge, but you're not necessarily a boss that's going to dictate to them, but you can work with them and listen to them, you have to have a keen ear and to be able to listen to the athletes because they have, and the officials, they have a lot of challenges that they will bring to you. And it's important that you don't dismiss any of them, like the lady with the bucket and the detergent. You know, there are some managers who would be insensitive to the point where they would run that young lady out and tell her, you know, no. You have to find a way to be diplomatic and to be able to command the respect and leave there with the respect intact. And I think that to me is really very important, you know. And just one quick story, coming out of Beijing, you know, after Beijing, we had this big function at Strawberry Hill, months after the athletes came back from Beijing. And the pre-activities didn't go well. So that by the time they got up to Strawberry Hill, it was very late. They had, remember, the parade through the city, that very late. And the food that, the preparation of that Strawberry Hill was not, were not good. So up to about midnight, we hadn't eaten. A couple of things happened. A couple of athletes, remember now, I'm the chef de mission, 2 months beyond the games, 2 months after the games. I don't have any contact with the athletes, right? And athletes would come to me and say, Mr. Chef de Mission. I said, my wife was in it. I said, but them don't know you're not the chef de mission anymore because they had no food up to 12 o'clock tonight and they're asking me about that as a problem. And I had to say, hey, you know, the fact of the matter is that they still look up to me or look across at me, whichever way you want to put it, and expect that they can bring some challenges to me. But the epitome of it all was Usain Bolt, who was then going to be awarded a national honor. And they had scheduled for him the following morning to go to rehearsals. It's now 12:30 the morning. And Usain Bolt is due at rehearsals at about 6 o'clock the following, later in the morning. Usain Bolt, the world record holder in 100 meters, 200 meters, 4x1 relay, comes to me and he says, Mr. Anderson, I want me to come to a rehearsal tomorrow. What do you think, sir? You think I have to go? 2 months after the games, you know, right? And I'm telling you that to say that's the level of rapport you want to establish with your athletes and the people with you. That they can feel months later, they can come to you and they can discuss issues like that and seek your advice on issues like this. To me, that to me is, it says that and convinced me that I must not have done a bad job. That they saw me 2 months later, no contacts in Beijing and that function, and could still look to me for advice and could come and talk to me about some of the challenges that they had.
No.
Indelible in my mind, on my heart as well.
Amazing, Don. Listen, man, we could talk for days.
We could talk for days.
Certainly, I have to tell my listeners that when I became chef de mission for our games, you were the first person I reached out to, and you gave me some advice. Some you mentioned here, others we haven't talked about, but those have helped with the two games that I've been to for Team Jamaica. And so trust me, it's worthwhile. And your book is still available. People can always get it, Soul to Beijing.
Yes, man.
It's very helpful to all my listeners who want to understand the inner works of what it takes to plan for our games. And as Dan said, up to 2 months after the games.
Yeah.
Yep. Appreciate it. Don Anderson.
A sequel to write.
Yeah, man. Don Anderson, thank you very much for stopping by, and I appreciate it.
My pleasure as always, man.
On behalf of producer Rashika Grant, Marsha Boyce, and the entire production team, thanks for joining us on this episode of the Drive Phase podcast. Remember, check out our website. It's thedrivephase.com. And make sure you subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or any podcast that you may use. Remember, we always appreciate ratings, and also tell a friend about it. Also, on our YouTube channel, The Drive Phase Media, our webinar is up and running. You can check out that webinar on safeguarding children in sports. That was a good one. So, until next time, see you then.